So one good question when you go to anything like this is, why should I listen to you? And you should be asking that. In terms of my qualifications to speak on this subject, the first is that I'm a Christian, is that I am committed to this work of the church in faith and in practice. Second, I'm a father of two daughters who are 5 and 10. For the last 8 years, I've had the privilege of being a full-time father, so I have put in the time of practice of learning how to do this rather than just sitting in an office reading and writing about it. Third, as an educator, after consulting in the financial services, I left to go and work in the New York City public schools, which was the hardest thing I've ever done, harder than living in Africa, which I have done, and my most embarrassing failure. I was not good at it, and I found myself mired in the pain of a particular community, and that was what started me asking the questions of, okay, I know I want to be part of the solution. Clearly, I'm not there yet. What's the nature of the issues, and how might I help to contribute? I've listed New Yorker as one of the pieces about me, because my wife and I lived there for 11 years. It is where we were formed, where we really grew into a church community as a couple, and it shapes everything that I do. As a result of being home with my kids, I wrote a book on early childhood parenting called The Apprenticeship of Being Human. That work, you will see some of it come out today in terms of the research. And then as an entrepreneur, it seems like a long time ago now. 8 or 9 years ago, a good friend and I started a web company for parents of young children called TumbleOn. It provides interactive developmental milestones to parents of young kids. And it was born out of my experience with parents. So I had a master's degree in education, tremendous privilege, and I, when I had my first daughter, was wondering, so what on earth do I do with an 18-month-old? And realized that for many of my parents, they didn't have any of those answers. They hadn't had any of those privileges. So we set out to provide a web app through which a parent with a fifth grade reading level could, in less than 5 minutes, know what are the 3 most important skills my child is developing, and what are some concrete, specific ways that I can support them? So it's something that I could take out of the kitchen and play with them. What is a really good book that I could read with them? Question for you. Who do you think shapes children more than anyone else?
Parents.
Well done, Blake. First right answer.
Genius.
When do they wield their greatest influence? I'm going to narrow in today on birth to 5, because that's the range that most experts call early childhood. Some will call it up to age 6. The reason that we focus on that period is because of the nature and rate of brain development. I don't know if you can see this from the back. This section right here is the first year. These are the next 15 years. So, you know, get a sense of space. They have expanded that first year, because otherwise those would be vertical lines. What that is measuring is the synapse formation. So how quickly the connections in the brain are being formed. The connections in the brain are formed, especially during the first 3 years of life, in response to stimuli. So what you experience shapes what synapses are created. There's something else amazing that goes on. So you can see from in utero, that's what the neural structure looks like. And it increases to this ridiculous web at 2 years old because of all of the experiences that kids are having. And that explains a little bit of how your 2-year-old acts, right? It is that messy. So God, by grace, has designed us that after that rapid period of proliferation, that there's a period of pruning. So neurologists say the neurons that fire together wire together, and that the others are pruned. And that's a really good thing, because you want to become good at things, and the things that you only have 1 or 2 experiences of are not important to being used on a repeated basis. So what this means in the life of the home is that whatever a child's repeated experiences are shape the physical structure of his or her brain for life. There's plasticity later, but this is what you're working with from the beginning. The Brookings Institution set out to explore in a large data set what are the correlations between important demographic factors and parenting quality. So they measured that by the responsiveness of parents to children, the way that they use words with them. And again, I hope you can see from the back, what they discovered is exactly what statisticians want. They wanted clear lines. So you can see the bars, blue bars go like this, light blue go like this on all of these factors. The first one is income. So across five quintiles, there's an almost perfect correlation between income and parenting quality. Same with education, being single, cohabiting, and being married. This one is race, which they parse carefully and say race is a proxy for culture. It's not a racial thing. And then age. The younger you are, the higher risk factor the higher risk you have of not being a good parent. So I want to zoom in on this one, because this is what really matters if we're caring for our neighbors who are in poverty. In the fifth income quintile, you can see the top income, you have the highest probability of having the strongest parents. In the lowest quintile, it's the exact opposite. The Pew Economic Mobility Project made headlines across the nation about 2 or 3 months ago because they saw this, that 41% of children who are born into the bottom income quintile will stay there as adults. Similar at the top. 41% of children born into the top income quintile will, at the age of 25, be in that same income quintile. And their concern was that this is sticky, right? That it's hard, especially for children in poverty, to break out. Now, do you see the parallels? Right? The quality of parenting is so strongly correlated at the extremes, and wealth stickiness is correlated in the same ways. I don't know of anyone who has yet done the data investigation to say there is even more than a significant statistical correlation here that we can come even closer to talking about causation. But it's too parallel just to say these things must not be related. James, yes, question.
Do we know what the breakdown of the actual income in those quintiles is? The income range for...
Just 20%, 20%, 20% is how they broke it up. Question.
When you're saying parental quality, do you know what measures whether it was a maternal sensitivity or...
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Maternal sensitivity, responsiveness. So neuroscientists talk about the importance of what they call serve and return interaction. So when I am talking to someone, something is happening different than when I am talking into a microphone. Likewise, when I'm hearing someone speak to me, something different is happening in me than the same person speaking on a screen. And that builds brain architecture. There is an economist from the University of Chicago named James Heckman who has devoted his mature life to investigating the relationship between early childhood and social thriving. This came about because he was put on a project to investigate the effectiveness of essentially a GED program. So the government wanted to know how effective is this alternative to high school program in order to get these people into the workforce. Heckman was part of the study. His depressing finding was that the kids who went through the GED program fared worse than those who had just stayed dropped out of high school. And he said, oh my goodness, we're trying to do something really good, but the billions of dollars that we're spending in that good initiative are not producing the fruit that we want. So then he started asking the questions, okay, if we're trying this remediation at high school with dropouts, is there a more effective time period to do that? And he just ran it backwards, and you can see the curve that he came up with. This is the rate of return to human capital for investment at different ages. This is where his study began, was the job training GED. And the closer he got to birth was the higher the yield. What are the gaps that exist between kids who grow up in disadvantaged families and those who grow up with resources? The first one is linguistic. The number and nature of those words heard in the home shape a child's vocabulary and their ability to use those words. The way God has designed us, that linguistic component feeds into the cognitive, because we're wired to learn through words. So the more words you hear and the more affirmations you hear early on in life, the more capacity you build at a cognitive level. Those two together feed into your social and emotional development. So the words that you have with which to communicate with others, the abilities that you learn to resolve conflict appropriately, allow you to navigate the social world at home, in the street, and eventually at school. How big are those gaps? A famous study that's now 17 or 18 years old established this quantitatively. There were two researchers in Kansas who said, we want to find out if there are meaningful lives in the differences of children. What we're going to do is we're going to take one of these and just put it on children in the home, and we're going to count the number of words that they hear on a daily basis, and then we're going to quantify it. How much of that is prohibition or denigration, and how much is affirmation? And we're going to see if statistically there's any sort of correlation with the child's home and then their later outcomes. What they found, and you can see here, is that a child born into a professional family, so one like mine, of a teacher, lawyer, doctor, by age three, would hear about 500,000 affirmations. A child in a family on welfare, by the same time, would receive about 80,000 affirmations. By contrast, the kids in the professional homes would hear, if I remember right, it was about 40,000 negations or denigrations, and the kids in welfare would have that same number. I'm sorry, it was 80,000. So the number of denigrations was the same as the affirmations, but then the kids in the welfare homes heard twice as many denigrations as they did affirmations. So you can see what this is doing to a child. If you're not hearing words that you can use to understand the world, and the ones that you are here are telling you either don't do that or you can't do that, it puts kids in a place where they're not willing to take the risks that they need to take in order to acquire the skills. Broken down at an hourly level, this is what it looks like. The kids from the more advantaged families are hearing more words, and the proportions of them are far weighted toward positive. And the kids at the bottom, most of what they're hearing is negative. So as I did this research, as I was working in the public schools and then being at home as a stay-at-home dad, I started connecting the dots and realizing that if I was going to be involved in serving my community and making any change, that the parents were the hub, because they were the ones who were affecting education. They were the ones who were affecting opportunity. Their income, as we saw from the Pew Center study, would predict their kids' own income later. And finally, the networks in which they ran affected their kids. So that's the nature argument, right? God has designed us in such a way that we are formed in early childhood, that it shapes the abilities for the rest of our lives. There's also a scriptural argument for engaging with families with young children for the good of those communities. What is striking to me is the language of Scripture in "to whom belongs the kingdom of heaven," right? We see Jesus says in the Beatitudes, "Blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And when the disciples push away the small children who want to come to him, he says, "Let the little children come to me, for to such as these belongs the kingdom of heaven." That we have a mandate not just by nature, because this is a critical period of development that affects kids for the rest of their lives, but because Jesus has set his favor on these people, and that they not only need to hear the gospel, they need to hear that good news that they've been loved, but in a very real sense, we need them, right? Jesus tells his disciples who follow him day and night to sit at the feet of these little kids, because unless you become like them, you won't enter the kingdom of heaven. So the opportunity for us is to enter into this with joy and passion, but also with humility, knowing that he said again and again, you need to learn from the poor, you need to learn from the children. Can anyone tell me How does Luke describe the mission of John the Baptist in Luke chapter 1? Does anyone remember the phrase? Yes? Do you remember the rest of it? Yes. And he will turn the hearts of the children. Pardon me. And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. And he will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared. As Presbyterians, we have a unique and beautiful understanding of the covenant family. And I want to encourage you that that vision of the covenant family is not just for the church, it is for our mission. Right? That John was sent out to restore this covenant family, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, not just to go to the children, saying, little children, come to me, but to restore this family, this created good design was part of Jesus' redeeming plan for the family. Which is why, of course, in each of the pastoral letters, you see there is a section addressed to households, right? Because he intended for this to be redeemed and restored. For the families with whom we work, we have a glorious message. We are saying not only does the announcement of Jesus' death and resurrection come to you to save you from your sin, it also is in this work of restoration. It has restored you to God through the reconciliation of the cross. It is restoring you to others, right? Through this parent-child relationship first, but then to all humanity through the cross. And in the world. That this child, when we announce the gospel, we say, what you experience as futility in this world is because of sin. But before that, God created it good. And now he's come into the world to give you a place in that world that is redeemed so that you can begin to work out a calling in that place in hope of his return. A friend and philosopher of mine sent to me, he read my book and he said, this really reminds me of Aristotle. And Aristotle, of course, said it better. He said, it makes no small difference then whether we form habits of one kind or another from our very youth. It makes a very great difference, or rather, all the difference. What we do repeatedly, scientifically, shapes the physical structure of our brain. What we do repeatedly, spiritually, forms our loves. Right? That's why Christian worship is formative. The practice of coming together weekly redirects our hearts to their true end. The practice of doing that daily, individually, and in our households is formative. It is directing our love so that we are not directed by the television or the internet or March Madness. I can tell what formative practices you've been doing. One of the most famous passages of formative practices is, of course, Deuteronomy 6. When I think about this, I think about creation design, right? Because this comes in the Pentateuch. This is the design that God had for his people. As I reviewed it, I realized it is the created design. It's also the redemptive design. That Moses speaks these words to his people after they've spent 40 years wandering in the desert because of their sin. And he's saying, I'm giving you this law. It's now today to be in your mouths, on your hearts, with your kids, on your walls, to remind them. Right? And that it's, well, let me read it and you'll get the immersive experience of Moses. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. When I read this, I think this was written by a preschool teacher, right? everywhere, right? Like multisensory, put it on your forehead. Tie another one on your wrist. Write it on the walls. If you go into a preschool classroom, this is how they're organized, right? So that all the senses are engaged. There are reminders everywhere. This is what we're learning. This is what we're doing. And what I want to remind you and myself at the same time is that this is not just the Old Testament creational design. This is the redemptive design. This is what was called for by Malachi, echoed by John in the turning the hearts of the fathers to the children. What would they have thought of? The responsibilities of fathers in Deuteronomy 6. Children grow into a story, grow into a narrative. This is without exception. It is not just Christian kids who are formed into a Christian story. The narrative that guides a family will always shape the children. It does so implicitly by initiation. So simply by participating in the rituals of family life, we're formed in certain ways. Which is why if you're born to a parent who is an avid basketball fan, you'll be initiated into those rituals, right? You will set your annual calendar by what happens in March. If you have someone else who is passionate about another vocation or avocation, that will inevitably shape who you are. Indoctrination, we often use as a dirty word. Historically, it's not. It means to teach the rudiments or the basics of something. And likewise, kids in every family are being indoctrinated, that is, taught the rudiments of a way of being, how to navigate the world. And finally, children indwell that story. They come to be characters in the story of which they are a part. One day after school, I was standing outside, and a father came to pick up his son, who goes to the same school as my daughter. And the son came out and was blabbering about NASCAR and who'd won a particular race that day. And I realized, this kid is in first grade, and he already knows all the drivers, their cars, because that's what his dad's passionate about. Right? That he has become this NASCAR child at 6 years old because of his family of origin. And that's true whatever our passions and interests are. I am convinced that God has so ordered the world in terms of nature and his plan that the world is latent with potential, and that latency is revealed and released by love. In other words, every child has inborn capacities, and those are meant to be made real and made actual by the practice of love. The way that you see this negatively and most tragically is in the neglect of children. So the Romanian orphanages are the classic case study of this, where children were neglected, not cared for. Their physical stature was smaller. They were emotionally withdrawn, cognitively delayed, even if they were in other measures, physically healthy, right? Because they had been neglected. What was created inside them could not be because it was meant to be expressed in love. And God has created the whole universe this way, right? If I go out in my backyard and I just throw seeds on the ground, they may grow. If I lovingly attend to them, if I put them in rows, if I put compost on them, if I water them when there's a gap in the rain, they will grow and flourish because their beautiful potential is meant most to be released in the presence of love. And the same is true with anything that you do, any of your crafts. If you are working with organic material like the soil or created things that people work with, if you don't care for it, it will not release its potential. In early childhood, that happens through three major mechanisms. So when I work with parents of young children, I say these are the hooks that you can do regardless of your literacy. You don't need to be able to read in order to do this, that will enable your children to develop in the ways that God has created them. The first is love. And again, with the Romanian orphanages, what these children lacked was attention and affection and affirmation. And when children have that, the physical touch, the words, I love you, and calling out the ability, saying, I see you're really good at that, or I see you love that, children live into that. Second, language, which we've already discussed in the negative sense of what happens when you're hearing denigrations instead of affirmations. What's happening when you hear only a few words? Well, you're stunted because God made your capacities to be released through the loving use of language. And finally, literature. I did a workshop earlier this week and had a parent come up to me afterward and she said, "Are you using literature pretty narrowly? Isn't there more to it than just books?" I said, yes, I'll qualify that. When I'm using literature, I'm using it for the alliteration. What I mean is beauty. So beauty in stories, it can come in film, it can even, God forbid it, come in television. These are the mechanisms by which we are brought beauty and story. And those stories and those pictures of beauty shape our children. Again, if you look at go to any major city, watch child and parent walking down the street, and see how the children literally walk like their parents, right? The same stride. See the clothing that they wear. They imitate, right? There is this unconscious and conscious continual imitation by which we take on the story of what it is to be human, of what it is to be beautiful, of what it is to be successful. In that, Christian worship plays a particularly important role. And this is true regardless of whatever particular culture or subculture we come from. In our church in New York City, at the beginning of Holy Week, so the Saturday before Palm Sunday, we have something called the Prayer Walk. And it is an immersive experience for kids of the experiences of Holy Week. There are several actors who act in mime all the events of Holy Week. And they do the same events every year. So the washing of the feet, going to Gethsemane to pray, going to Golgotha, and then seeing Jesus go into the tomb. And the way the building is built, there's a chapel on one floor, and two floors up is the gymnasium. And so the children know Jesus is going to go down into the grave. From the chapel, he goes out through this tunnel of chairs. Then he goes up through the secret stairway in the back up to the gym where we celebrate the resurrection. My youngest daughter was 2.5 when we moved from New York City to Charlottesville. 2 years later, she could recite for me all the events of that Passion Week because of her two experiences of that immersive experience of this is what happened during Holy Week. The rehearsal and particularly the enacting, right? So in Galatians 3 it says, "It was before your eyes that Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified," that our children are initiated into that story in multi-sensory ways. I'd like to take 2 minutes for you to turn to your neighbors and talk about how have you seen that done well. It could be through the church, it could be through a backyard Bible club, but ways that Christian worship has been formative for young children. On the sheet that you have, there are 3 questions that you can use to guide that discussion. After about 2.5 minutes, I will call you back and we'll share some of them up here. Okay, I'm going to interrupt you in order to get your attention back up front so you can share with one another. What did you hear from each other that was formative in terms of worship?
Object lessons during children's sermons.
Okay, it was said object lessons during children's sermons. Yes?
Using drama, we don't see that much in the church. Using drama with kids, obviously.
Right, yeah, using drama or puppets is a great example.
Talk about the resurrection eggs. Yes, yeah. They're very effective.
Great. Resurrection eggs are one example.
Talk about hands-on play that guided through the story.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit more about hands-on play?
Well, Well, she talked about it, so.
The good idea is right next door.
I have a course for an Episcopal church, and they have this program called
Godly Play.
And when I saw her walking through the classroom, I just thought, why don't we do this? Like, I mean, it's fantastic what the kids are in my little children, and they know all the biblical stories so well because they've been immersed in this program for the last several years.
Yeah. Does anyone else know Godly Play? So it's, yes, in the back. Basically, it's Sunday school meets Montessori. So it is storytelling, very tactile. There's often a board on which the characters move, and the children are responsible for moving the little characters around the board as it's happening, and then for being able to retell the story as they move those pieces.
What's it called?
Godly Play. I highly recommend. There's another similar one called The Lamb's Liturgy. Both are excellent. But I think you also had your hand raised to share something else.
Yeah, I've done something with my children before. It's sort of like resurrection meringues.
Okay.
I don't know if people know what meringues are, but they're basically a cookie sort of made out of egg whites.
Right.
And so as you're making a meringue the night before, as you're whipping the egg whites, you talk. There's a series of things you talk to your children about. So as you're whipping them, you talk about the fact that Jesus was beaten. And you can add a little vinegar to the recipe, and you talk about how Christ was offered a little vinegar. And anyway, there's a series of things like this as you're making meringues that you talk about how things have happened to Christ leading up to his crucifixion. And then the oven is being preheated this whole time. And when you're all done, you put them on the tray, you turn the oven off, and you stick them in the oven, and that's the tomb, and then the children seal the oven. And you all go to bed, and it's, and they're like, but, and you're like, nope, that was it. It was over. It's all. And the next morning when you get up, the meringues have cooked. And so you pull them out of the oven, and you can unseal it after they've gone to bed. And when you crack them open, the way meringues cook, they end up rising in a hollow in the middle. And so then the grave is empty. So it's kind of cool.
So to summarize for the recording, resurrection meringues are a great way for children to see the story of the death and resurrection and get to taste it on Easter morning. Anyone else? Yes?
I just think repetition, we're very big on storytelling, and we have a brother called Mom and me, where Mom's come with their preschooler, and we tell the story, whether it's a Christmas story or the Easter story. And so I'll usually break it down in a way that this is what happened when the kids repeat it with me and do actions. And then when
right.
we go on to, like, first, you know, the angel told Mary, and then Mary and Joseph go to Bethlehem. They'll have actions to do with each one. And as we go along, we have to go back, okay, can you remember step one, step two, step three?
Right.
And then they go home with a box of artifacts that they've collected that go with each one and can retell the story then too. Dad or
their
brothers or sisters, things like that.
Right. So there's a storytelling that is involving the children. It's kinesthetic in moving them around. It's tactile and visual in having something that they take home. And they're responsible for it as participants, not just as recipients. Good. What else? To speak. Yes, go ahead.
Anne was sharing about how her daughter, like, even talked about being in nursery care, and how during that time, like, you can use that time to be telling the children stories, and not just view it as a time of just strictly child care, but using the time to just tell stories.
Very true. And Godly Play stages right down to, I think it's like 1.5. So there is this growth into being able to participate in the story in more meaningful ways, because, as you know, they're ready for it, right? They love to sit and listen to the stories. They love to touch the little characters. Good. At our church, we are using a children's worship curriculum that's being written by one of our parishioners, and it's very repetitive, and it is striking to me because I only teach it once every or twice every 6 weeks, how the kids have just soaked it up. So there is a script that we rehearse. This is what we do every week in Christian worship. And for 3 weeks, we focus on one of each of those elements. So they're understanding what we're doing, not just doing it week after week, and then doing it in a way that is appropriate and engaging to them. And so because there's sort of the drop-in, drop-out, it's not a Sunday school, it's just for the 4-, 5-, and 6-year-olds during the sermon, I thought, some of it's going to stick, some of it not. It's amazing. The kids, their brains are like glue. I want to shift now to honoring the poor. So I said before that one of our calls into this work is the way that Jesus honors the poor and children and calls us to learn from both of them. In James, the scriptures say, "Listen, my beloved brothers, has not God chosen those who are poor in the world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom, which he has promised to those who love him?" And with the widow who put her last mite into the offering box, he says, "Truly I say to you, this widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the offering box." So my question for you is, how have you seen that work? How have you seen the poor honored through the practices of worship? How have you been able to recognize that truly their gifts are more valuable? Truly that Jesus has chosen those who are poor in the eyes of the world to be rich in faith? Go ahead, turn to your partners. I'll give you about another 2 minutes again, and then we'll share. Okay, can I call your attention back up front again so you can share with one another? How have you seen the poor honored and celebrated?
We talked about when they come, and we were in the prayer in Bible study this morning. We talked about James 1 and 2 and that, so we've already been talking about that this morning, but people do come to the church on a Sunday morning, or call for assistance or whatever, and you invite them to a service and they come, it's not just what do you want or what can we do for you, it's extending the welcome and invitation to be a part of the community. Mm-hmm. And that dignifies them and honors them and the person and the created image of God that they are.
Right. So if I hear you right, it's treating that person not just as an object in need of assistance, but as someone who's welcomed into the community of faith.
Right, and somebody that can add value.
Great. Yes?
I think one of the things that our congregation has been blessed by is their prayers. Hmm. The people of the prayers experiences different economic classes, different struggles and backgrounds that they come from. When we have a time of corporate prayer and they pray, I feel like,
and it's not to label someone's one. I just feel like some of our dear friends, the prayer that they pray has been blessed worship. Good. So, the poor pray differently, right? Good. What else? Yes. Right. That's great. So having a church that is not all put together is a real asset because people know that they're needed to participate. Great. Yes?
I think similar lines. Someone in my group was sharing, like, how do we talk about the poor and setting the poor when we're entering into a stage of maybe our church is starting to diversify in terms of wealth. So we actually have people who are materially poor coming into our congregation. In my experience, I kind of a church who had already crossed that point and had a very diverse church in terms of material. Well, we just talked about poverty as both being poor materially and being poor spiritually, and it put us all on level ground, and I think that really helps.
Great. So it was not just the welcome, but it was also the language that you used among yourselves to talk about poverty. Mm-hmm. Good. Anything else? Yes.
Well, on top of that, I mean, it's not only just the language, but like a communal recognition that we're all poor spiritually. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's an equality there, and that we're coming together like equally. You know, it's not this poor group over here. Yes, there's like all these material things. We need to be aware of that, and the experience of a poor person in my community and the experience of me as an affluent person is different, but there's a shared conversation to be had there about the things we're all struggling with.
Right. So, to reiterate, acknowledging our own poverty is critical. Yes?
I think, too, there could be something to be said for if you as a church really feel that your congregation is being called to minister to the poor, and you have an immediate community that you could do that with, to reaching out to some of those people who maybe you've already had some interaction with, which is most likely if that's what your church is being called to, and calling them in as experts.
Hmm.
Because when you haven't lived that life, you're not really entirely sure how to help them. You can guess at it. But I think there's some real empirical evidence that says when you turn to somebody who's poor, somebody who is a drug addict, somebody who has a problem with skipping school all the time, truancy, and you say, we really need you to help us figure out how to stop this problem or how to assist in other people who are experiencing this problem. You're really an expert on this.
Right.
Suddenly you raise them up
right.
as being important. You know a lot more about this than we do.
You're right. So we can value the experiences and wisdom of the poor by treating them as experts on their own condition and the condition of their community, and engaging them in that process of identifying what supports are needed and what can or can't be provided from outside that community. Yes?
I think it's an honor just to be invited to a place anyway and to be made feel not only needed or like you're an expert, but desirable just because you were created in dignity. And so to invite people just to spend time with us and to eat with us, I mean, the same way that we feel honored by being invited to a wedding or to a birthday party, just to come and be and exist with
right.
a people group who wants to talk to you.
Right. And in my experience, domestically and internationally, that sort of community hospitality is almost universal among the poor, right? That no matter how little there is so frequently a welcome to participate in whatever little there is in some sort of meal or celebration. Yes?
Early in our church plan, we had a man walk into our church. His name was Raymond. You know? And he just walked in, and we all got to know him, and he said he was going to be clean and sober, and every time he comes back periodically, and every time he tells us how long it's been, we have like a little celebration, everybody claps, and we recognize him, and how many years has that?
It's been, I mean,
I almost think 3 years, maybe 3 or 4 years, and it's like he just loves to be the center of attention, and we celebrate it,
yeah.
And it's great, we all just... He comes around and greets everybody like we're all family. And he's not a member, but he comes in once in a while, and it's like we've all become part of his little.
Yeah. And it is really important to celebrate the successes and the dignity of people who maybe have never felt celebrated before. Yes.
Well, and one of the things that Raymond did a couple years ago was he came up to me and he said, "I can't read."
Hmm.
And I said, "Okay." He said, "Well, you show me how to read." So we started talking about reading. And anyways, he decided he was going to take it upon himself to learn how to read the Bible.
Wow.
So he started with this other family studying the Bible. And he came back a couple weeks later, and he showed me this whole notebook.
Hmm.
And he had written out, like, page after page of scripture.
Wow.
And he memorized it all. And then through that, he started reading. And it just meant a lot to him that we were celebrating in his accomplishment. And I told him, I said, I think you have memorized, I've been a Christian many, many years, and you have memorized far more scripture.
Right.
Maybe because of the fact that you couldn't read initially, but now that you can, even more so.
Right.
And I mean, it was really amazing.
Absolutely. I'm going to move us on just because I want to keep moving, not because this sharing isn't good. We've been addressing this implicitly in our previous discussion of welcome. Jesus' awful, terrible words at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. If you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do that? You therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And so I've heard you already asking, how can we grow in community with the poor? How can we celebrate them, honor them, rejoice with them, be humbled by them? I've had this experience a couple times in the last year in a prayer group that, Lord willing, will become a church plant. It's a mixture of race and economics. And I learned, not from this woman, but from someone else in the group, that there was a woman in the neighborhood who had her neighbor had died, and she had adopted her neighbor's children. And it was a rebuke to me, because I knew how little she has in terms of resources. And yet, this is what love required of her. So she gladly did it, and she wasn't parading around like, look, I adopted my neighbor's kids. But for the rest of us, it was a call to more holiness and commitment. And relatedly, in that prayer group, as was mentioned, hearing my brothers and sisters pray. There's one woman who is, she would say, she was put in special ed. She's learning disabled. But her trust and her prayer is so beautiful and simple, and obedient, and as a rebuke to the rest of us of our unwillingness to come to Jesus like little children. In the next 5 minutes or so, I'm going to highlight for you three promising paradigms that are institutional in their nature in addressing early family life for the good of communities and in the name of Christ. They're doing it in different ways and with different degrees of success. And in different degrees of scale. After that, I'll share a few little glimpses into like the first steps there, and then solicit from all of you out loud, what have you seen of your churches, your neighbors doing this well? Thanks. The first promising paradigm is something called the Jeremiah Program. It started in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as a multi-generational way to address single parenting. Their mission is to provide safe, affordable housing for single mothers. These places that they secure are off-limits to men in order to make that a delineated safe place for those families. It involves parent education for the moms, life skills training, career development. They are required to be completing whatever their next phase of their education is, whether that's completing a GED or community college or college, so that it is not just trying to put them into a dead-end job in order for them to have a job. It's looking beyond that to vocational development. Sewn into all of this is childcare for the children under three, and then preschool for the children above three before they enter school age, where the children are in this together, so they have a sense of being part of a community. The Jeremiah program in Minneapolis has been tremendously successful in the women transitioning from dependence to independence, of making those transitions of parenting, life skills, and career development, during which time their children are being cared and supported for during the day while mom acquires those skills in ways that they are confident that these moms can continue on that trajectory and break the cycle of multi-generational poverty. It has been replicated in Austin, Texas. There's another site in the works in my hometown of Fargo, North Dakota, which I hope will take off soon. And we're exploring it in Charlottesville. It began as a faith-based initiative. It has lost some of that distinctive quality, from what I can tell, in the way that they present themselves now. They're very open to it, particular communities sort of breathing faith back into it, because that was one of our concerns in the relationship, is could we be very Christian in the way that we do this, and you can. But it is a promising paradigm. It was featured in the New York Times last week, that hopefully we will see more of in the future. Second is the Talitha Kum Institute in Waco, Texas. This is a more distinctively Christian intervention. They have what they call a therapeutic nursery. So recognizing that the children that they serve have already had experience of toxic stress that will affect their brain development and their ability to learn and to participate well in school. They have a baby mentoring program that pairs volunteers from the community with the children and the families in addition to the therapeutic nursery. They recognize that early intervention is really important, so they're doing screening for disability testing early on. They have parenting classes and job training assistance, because they're, like the Jeremiah program, realizing that the whole family matters. If I was to compare the two, I would say Talitha Kum probably does a stronger job with the children, and the Jeremiah Project does a stronger job with the moms. The third and largest is a phenomenal initiative in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I was asked to write about this for Cardis magazine, Comment magazine, produced by Cardis probably a year and a half ago, and I'd never heard of it. So I began doing what sort of scavenging research work I could to figure out what it was and what it was about. The backstory is that the Doug and Maria DeVos Foundation, based in Grand Rapids, came to the Grand Rapids Public Schools and said, how can we help? You have a high school graduation rate of just over 50%. Anyone with means gets their kids out of the Grand Rapids Public Schools, because they know there's this toxic educational culture. What's going on? How could we help? And so they began this process of needs and assets assessment of the community, addressing what is there, what's not there, what are the pieces that need to be in play. And they masterfully were able to craft a coalition of over 100 organizations, faith-based, nonprofit, for-profit, public education, after-school programs, to share revenue. So through the DeVos Foundation and Kellogg grants and other things that they've been able to secure, there is distributed money. They have to share information in real time. So the hospital service, so they know when a child is born in their target community. That information is passed on to the maternal child health workers. It's now 4 years ago, they had a low birth weight rate in Grand Rapids of 17% of African American children were low birth weight, which is a terrible predictor of later health outcomes. Within 3 years, it had dropped to 7%, and half of the community outreach workers who were doing the work after that three-year period were moms who had gone through the program. So they were starting right at the beginning in terms of getting the health right. They have a baby scholars program, which is, I don't want to say glorified preschool, because it's preschool, but it's even better than preschool, as well as their parent university. So they're doing both and at the same time, talking to one another. Different organizations are running these, but they all know what they're doing at the same time, so there's not duplication or redundancy. That information is feeding into the public schools so that the kids are well prepared for school. The parents understand their role in formation, and then the schools can begin to do their work, because the kids are not at a huge deficit when they enter. They also recognize there are zillions of after-school programs trying to provide effective aftercare, but not doing a very good job of education or providing a safe place. They said, okay, if you want to play in this game, you have to submit to those things. Share metrics, share information, and then we can provide revenue. They've organized 17 different sites that operate in this target zone so that there's clear and consistent quality for those children, clear expectations for the parents of if your child's going to participate, this is what it's going to mean. They recognize the summer gap that happens between years, did the same thing, finding who provides summer care, You're all going to be on the same team, all in the same program. You have to submit to the same metrics so that we can actually track which of these summer programs are preventing the gaps that happen again and again and again. And then the last thing I should mention is gatherings of hope. So they gathered 100 churches in Grand Rapids and said, would you be willing for 12 weeks, 8 to 12 weeks, host a gathering. The first hour is going to be a meal where the families sit down together and talk with one another. There will be a facilitated conversation so that families learn to talk to each other. Then the kids are going to go out and have tutoring. During that time, there's going to be mentoring for the parents. Then you're all going to come back for a time of worship. They found this is a really promising model. They didn't work out the kinks. For some churches, it worked well. Others, it didn't really. The metrics were scattered in terms of its effectiveness. But it was an amazing example of 100 churches saying, yes, we want to be part of the solution to our community's historic problems with education in a worshipful, Christian, formative way. Because of time, I'm going to save this for after the next slide. My aim today was to convince you that early childhood is the critical period in education by nature and by scripture, that parents are the key stakeholders, both empirically and because God has given them that role, that Christ calls us not just to those children, but to their families because that's his covenant of love, and that our work as churches is formation and not just education, that the whole experience of families and communities is formative, and that the promising paradigms are holistic. Yesterday, Chip Sweeney was saying at their church they have this dream big, start small, go deep. And I think that's where we need to dream big. What is possible in our communities? I would not have thought that what Believe to Become is even possible, but they started with a big dream. They started small in just having community gatherings of asking what are the assets and needs. And now they're starting to reap the fruit of that. One of the most hope-giving stories to me is of this little girl. Can anyone name her? Yes, Ruby Bridges. So this little girl, Ruby Bridges, was integrated in the first elementary school to be, or one of two parallel, but she was the only one at the William France Elementary School in the process of desegregation. Robert Coles was a pediatric psychiatrist trained at Harvard who happened to be there at the time, offered his services pro bono to the family because he couldn't imagine what this little girl was going through, and had the opportunity to sit with her one-on-one and ask, how are you not totally falling apart, right? You're walking with federal marshals every day to school with people with caskets of black children, but you don't seem affected by it. And as a result, there was both a book that Coles wrote and a movie made. And the book, well, each has their beauties. In the movie, Coles asks her to draw a picture of the people as she's walking through the crowds. And she draws a picture, no faces on the pictures. I said, you walk through these crowds every day, twice a day. How can you not know what their faces look like? She said, my mommy and daddy told me not to look at them, so I don't. Right? Like 6 years old, it just had been so internalized in the beauty of her Christian family. My parents told me not to do this, so I don't do it. In the book, as Coles narrates it, on one occasion, she stopped in the middle of the screaming mob on her way into school. Her teacher is looking out the window and sees her stop and is really terrified because they're yelling, she stops, she never stops. And she appears to be saying something, comes into the school. And teacher comes over and says, are you okay? What happened? You never talked to them. Why were you talking to the crowd? And Ruby said, I wasn't talking to them. She said, Ruby, I saw you. Your lips were moving. And she says, I wasn't talking to them. I was praying for them. And she said, every day, on the way to and from school, I pray for them. Father, forgive them, because they don't know what they're doing, just like they didn't know what they were doing when they crucified your son. Her family, though poor, her dad was a sharecropper, her mom scrubbed floors at a bank, had taught this little girl, this six-year-old, the beauty of the gospel so much that she changed the course of American history. They didn't know she was going to be important, right? They were just parents loving their kids, telling them, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. And this six-year-old believed the gospel and rebuked all of us. And that's our hope in engaging with poor families. It's not going to be our success, right? It is their trust in Jesus and his ability to come alongside them and to create that beautiful covenant family that rebukes us all and renews society. And I think I have 1 minute left. Are there any questions? If not, let me give you one small, beautiful glimpse into ways that this can happen. My friend Sarah went to NYU in New York, was living down near NYU, felt led by God to move from there up to the South Bronx because she just felt her privilege. Started meeting her neighbors and getting to know them in love. Started having kids show up at her apartment for her to feed them and help them with their homework. And began growing in love with this neighborhood. And realized pretty quickly, I could be feeding kids and doing homework every night, but I'm not sure that I'm going to make a dent in this. And so she asked a mother of high school students who had been a preschool teacher, she said, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm a just out of college kid living in the South Bronx. I want to love my neighbors. What can I do? They together started a weekly gathering for moms with their young children in their apartment where they read children's books and pray together. And it is growing. They're in their third year now and moving toward like sort of institutional status where they can do it in a place other than just their apartment. But it was these first movements of love toward a community that recognized the needs of that community and then wanted to see something beautiful grow within the family so that the patterns of generational poverty could be broken. So the word of hope to you is it doesn't take a massive institution like Believe to become. It just starts with those little actions of love. Thank you all, and I will cut off just so that we honor our time.